1983. I'm here with Steve Oreda. We are interviewing Mr. Lee Burns, former director of University Housing, on his career in housing and as director of housing.
I went out to Glacier Park in the fall of 1928, and 29 I spent those two summers out at Glacier Park. And I started out as a busboy, and then went into the swimming pool and fishing guide, and my brother and I. And then I'd sub once in a while up in the dining room, and Don Halverson and Dr. Anias were visiting there, and they came down and wanted to go on a fishing trip, and I took them and up part up a mountain there just to show them around a little more. And so Don asked me where I was going to school, and I said, well, I didn't know, but my friend and I had been talking about Wisconsin, and boy, oh boy, his ears went up, and he said, well, if you come down, I'll try to get you a job. And so I went I spent 1 year in San Francisco in between there, and then I came back here, and I was anxious to get going on the the university, and came down, and first weekend was a big banquet in Great Hall, and gee whiz, they had all older women doing the serving, and I thought that was rather strange, and so I asked Don why we couldn't have university students, and he thought it was a wonderful idea, and talked with Porter Butts, and so we changed over all of our catering at the Union to students, and I worked there for 1 year, and then started school, and I took 1 year in law school, then I shifted to the Commerce School, and I graduated, in 1933, I think it was. And at the Union, I had charge of the catering students, all the parties there. And likewise, then I moved in so I could be on the grounds at night, and I took my accounting and that, and they offered me a full-time job, which I was very happy about. And I worked in the accounting office, and plus the
accounting office for the university?
For the Union, and residence hall. Actually, Mr. Halverson was director of residence halls, and then he also worked with Mr. Butts, and he was a steward and took care of the businessman matters and the food service. And he was a great guy. And I think that the residence halls attracted me very much because of their house fellow program. It's really the heart of this residence halls whole program.
Tell us what the house fellow program was like that made it attractive to you.
Well, first of all, instead of having large dormitories, they had them split up in fairly small units from Tripp and Adams.
Now we're talking about the early 1930s here?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And halls were filled, and the business office worked out of the Union, mm-hmm. And it was sometime later when they shifted over and separated, and I went with the residence halls, and I enjoyed it. We had our, first of all, we had our accounting and everything at the Union Building, and then gradually got started over in the halls themselves.
Now, why was that split? Why did that split occur?
Well, we were building the new wing in the Union, the theater, mm-hmm. which was one big job, and then we were building what the Cronsage units and the Elizabeth Waters Hall. Elizabeth Waters Hall was the one that I first started mm-hmm. working on, and Don gave me a lot of opportunities as far as the working on the plans and the purchasing of the furniture and the equipment and all that, and I worked with the our interior decorator and the purchasing department.
So you were an accountant at this time when you were doing this?
I was called an assistant steward and assistant to the director, and went to the university, and I enrolled there in 1930 as a sophomore in the Commerce School, and as I said, in accounting, business administration. Also took four or five classes in law school before I decided business administration was what mm-hmm. I was interested in. I was always interested in training and having people know their jobs and whatnot. And for a football banquet or anything like that, we would have the all written out just exactly what they were supposed to do, and the waiter instructions for people, and it was sort of fun, and I think we were doing some pioneering in some of the areas there. And Mr. Halverson was very, very good to give me a lot of responsibility. And I graduated in 1934, and so we're celebrating our 50th anniversary next fall. And I've been working on a few on the committee, and because I love it here. But last night was terrible. Coming up Langdon Street in the midst of
registration.
Boy, oh boy, it was something.
You mentioned that you were involved in some pioneering efforts. What were some of the pioneering efforts as you perceived them?
Well, I felt strongly that we ought to have students doing the waiting mm-hmm. at the Union. Mm-hmm. And so we did all of our catering, later the grill, cafeteria. About 90% of the people were student workers.
Still today, too.
And they still are today. And we did a better job, I think, than the older women, as far as serving was concerned, quicker, faster. And the kids got 30 cents an hour, plus a meal, and then it went to 35 cents an hour.
Inflation.
Up and away. Up it went.
And in 1937, I was promoted to assistant director residence halls. They were expanding fast, and we needed to spend all of our time there. And I had been in the accounting cashier's office at the Union as assistant steward with special assignments in the food department. So then in 1937, I was transferred and became assistant director of residence halls.
Before we get into the assistant director years, can I go back over
sure.
and ask a few questions? We're going to go back to when Mr. Halverson first met you in Glacier Park
oh, yeah.
for a minute. Now, you said he was with a Dr. Antonius?
Antonius.
Now, who is he?
Well, there are a pair of twins. Leslie and Lester Antonius. Leslie Antonius is still practicing dentistry. Lester Antonius is in the home out here with multiple sclerosis and completely vegetable practically. And so I been friendly with them, of course, for many, many years. Lived with Leslie right up here on the, and Johnny Walsh, who used to be
boxing
coach. As a student, we had some good times, but we worked like hell.
But were they just friends of Mr. Halverson's?
Yes.
And they were not associated with the university in any official capacity?
Lester was, the one that was ill, was at the Union.
Oh, he was?
Okay. Yes.
Mm-hmm. When you approached, or Mr. Halverson approached you, Mr. Halverson, as I'm sure you know, hired a lot of people. You know,
yes.
He'd go around and he'd see people he liked. What was his pitch with you?
He liked the way I was waiting on table at the Union. And then Dr. Ananias wanted to go climb a mountain. Well, we went up about a third of the way up, and that was enough for him. But I took him fishing. He said, well, if you come down to Wisconsin, well, maybe we can find you a job. So I did come down here. I worked at the Union in the catering department.
And he found you a job right away then?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. At the catering department, actually the captain, Dr. Hugo Baum, who preceded me as the head waiter there at the Union, and he was in the medical school, and so when he graduated, I took over.
Mm-hmm.
After I graduated, assistant steward in charge of the accounting office at the Union. The Union and the residence halls were together as far as the business arrangements were concerned. Porter Butts was the social director, and Don Halverson was the financial manager and the business manager. I worked under Halverson, and the thing that interested me most about the halls were the house fellow system, how it worked. It really is.
That's where I want to go next. Now, you said, and Mr. Halverson has told us that the system was small and personal. Now, how was the house fellow hired, first of all?
By a committee, a faculty committee, and later we had a screening committee where present house fellows would interview them and give their impression of the people. And then the faculty committee, which consisted of people like Professor Dr. Bradley,
mm-hmm.
and Harold Bradley, and Professor Kowalki, mm-hmm. and really interesting people and wonderful people. What was her name? Myers. And we had one with the women house fellows too. But the house fellows had their own committee for the screening of house fellow candidates. And so we got the feeling of this person would be, looks like a natural, and so on. But
so it wasn't a set of specific set criteria, it was more or less general impressions.
General impression and reasonably good grades, and whether they were athletes or not, we would take them because sometimes they'd be missing somewhat with their practices. But even so, we had wonderful young people who were close to the students.
Mm-hmm.
And in each house, and there are about 35 to 50 people in each house, and they set up their own government, and they wanted their own store, and they put in a store in the basement of Gilman House, and they were a very active group,
mm-hmm.
and they were older sometimes, but sometimes young men and women who were leaders, and they really would mold their house together, and then they'd have their own government. And their,
you said that there were women house fellows as
yes,
well, and
yes.
These would be for the girls' dorms.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And the same criteria would be
the same thing. Yes.
Now,
juniors or seniors.
But there was a special committee that elected women opposed to the.
Yes. Yes.
Two different.
Yeah, that's right. There was a women house fellow committee of the house fellows who screened them, and then they would send them on to the residence halls committee, and that was professors and some of the head residents in the halls.
How much were the dean of students involved in this whole process?
Very much. Not in a direct manner, but always if we were going to hire a head resident, what they call now, some of them house mothers or that, would always go through the dean office so that she approved of them. And she was on the faculty committee, as was Dean Goodnight on the men's halls faculty committee. And so we worked closely with the deans in the broader sense, but and then as far as the operation of the halls, they didn't have anything to do with it.
Yeah, that was more.
But it was much more Don Halverson who really set the standards and on the food it was, he had the imagination and the leadership qualities that were tremendous.
Now you said, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it sounds as if like each different residence hall more or less assumed its own personality based on the house fellows and on whoever was in it.
And the students.
Now if the students decided let's get a store or let's have a all campus party or something like that, how would they go about, what was the step-by-step process in getting permission?
They would come to the director, assistant director, and
not the house fellow, but they
No, usually. There'd be house fellows on their their committees, and find out whether or not there would be space, whether or not they could do it.
Mm-hmm.
And from then on, the men's halls store was a very, very active unit, but it was run by students. But they would hire student managers, and we tried to let them do as much as we possibly could. And this was the philosophy of Don, and it filtered down through myself and Newell and Smith I think the house fellow groups were just terrific, and we'd go with them on picnics, and we'd have our training sessions at the start of the year.
Well, you would have training sessions for the house fellows.
For the house fellows.
Conducted by you and
that's
Mr. Halverson.
Right.
And
some of the head residents and the dean of men and dean of women would always be
participating. What would you tell them at this?
Mostly that they should students not set themselves off, and once they were in a house they should be interested in that particular house and that particular group. And we expected a kid that got in trouble would first go to his house fellow, and then if it looked serious or they needed help, why then we had a head resident and assistant Arnie Damon, who had the men's halls, house fellows, and they would meet weekly and discuss different things. But we tried to leave it with the students and the house fellows. Of course, we were always had a staff member available for them, whatever they wanted. And when they wanted any new project or get a radio station set up, why we help them through the WHA staff to start that. And they had a good radio station, and tremendous. A lot of students went from such activities into the same sort of activities when they got out.
Any great failures on the students' parts, you know, where they started something and...
I don't know. I'm sure there were, but trying to...
I just seem to remember something Mr. Halverson said about sometimes they learn through their failures more than they learn through their successes.
I think that's true. And they'd have real big ideas. And we try to tone them down and down a little bit, you know. And sometimes they'd be the in the right, and sometimes they'd be in the wrong. But we had a good relationship with our house fellows, I think, and with our students. Of course, there would be some cases that would go to the dean's office, and Scott Goodnight and Louise Troxell were always very, very helpful. As were their successors, and they were on the faculty committee. We had like Professor Kowalki, Harold Bradley, on the men's faculty committee.
Now, which committee is this?
This is a men's faculty committee for residence halls.
For residence halls. Is that down there?
Mm-hmm. Then there were the dean of women, also, and outstanding women professors were on the Women's Halls Faculty Committee. Mm-hmm. Then in the Women's Halls, we had a head resident who was a graduate woman, a little bit more mature, who headed up the house fellow in each group. The Barnard had a head resident, and Chadburn had a head resident, so that they likewise were in somewhat on the selection or screening of the house fellows, so that we would get good people that were liked by the rest of the girls and who were competent, and they had to have fairly good grades too, or we could.
Let's say that your committee selected me, a graduate student in political science, to be a house fellow for the year, and I went through the training program that you talked about. Okay, it's registration week now. What might my duties for the week look like?
It would be to be in your house as much of the time as you could, to welcome the new students, greet their parents, show them around, see if there are any problems, advise them where to go, where registration was. And probably that was too late for them, but there were always things that questions that they had. But we felt that the house fellows and the head residents of the women's halls were there to welcome the parents, talk with them, and any problems that come up. It started with the house fellow generally reporting it to the faculty committee, and the faculty committee would discuss it with the deans, and nine times out of ten, why they could settle it and work it out. We didn't do advising on which courses to take, but I'm sure which professors they liked and whatnot
was
fun. Yeah, and we'd have faculty people in as much as we could, and the groups, the houses would invite people. There were some very, very favorite people that the faculty members that they were always after.
I have that question down in just a minute, but before we get to that, the professors, I want to ask one more question on the house fellow. Okay, now I've been a house fellow for a while. I've greeted the parents and everything. The semester is rolling along quite well. Let's just pick a typical Wednesday in the middle of the semester. What would my responsibilities be as a house fellow from the time I got up until the time I went to bed?
Well, besides your class and classwork, we wanted our house fellows to stay around the house as much as they could. And that was no hard rule or no set hours or anything like that, but we wanted them available. And they would likewise work with the student groups, planning their parties, planning open house and things like that. And we want our house fellows to spend as much time as they could in the house when they're off hours. There was no set time that they had to be there. But evenings, we'd like to have them around quite a bit, unless there were big parties. Because there are always questions, or visitors coming, or a couple students get tangled up together. And if it was serious, why, they would be referred to the dean of men or the dean of women's office and keep them informed. They met weekly in a dinner meeting and discussed any large problems, like one house shooting firecrackers off, or having a water fight once in a while, especially in the quadrangles and Crippen Adams. That was a beautiful spot to drop a bag of water on somebody. But we want our fellows to be around the house as much as they can.
What about during mealtime?
At first we had waiter service, but that was only for a few years, and then we went to cafeteria service because the students liked it much better because it was much more flexible, and they could come most any time. They could select their food.
And when was that? When did that switch occur? Do you have
idea. About in the 35, 36.
So for about 10 years, they had.
Yes.
Was
waiter
it
service
the students who wanted to switch, or was it just the number of students, the demand that?
It was when we started building. We had Elizabeth Waters Hall, which was a big new building. And there we started with cafeteria service, and we started at Carson Gully Hall in the early 30s, I would say 35, 36.
Mm-hmm.
We went to cafeteria service rather than the sit-down service. Barnard and Chadburn were the last that went over to the cafeteria service. Girls seemed to like the sit-down service for a while, but then they liked actually the cafeteria service much better, and we could have more choices for them, and they didn't mind carrying their trays.
So it was pretty much student demand that dictated the.
I think so, and it was a easier operation than now at the Union Building, of course. For all catering, and likewise for any banquets, we always served table service, and for a while Sunday noon meals, we had table service in the women's halls. But the fellows liked the cafeteria service, and we wanted them dressed fairly well, and generally coats and ties, or if not respectable, and if we'd never turn them away from a meal, but their house fellow would hear about it, and he'd talk with them.
Wasn't exactly a no shirts, no shoes, no service thing, but
there was a leisurely dress code, but there was no coats, ties, or any of that.
While we're on that topic, because I just may not forget to come back to later on, when did that discontinue?
I think in about 35 or so. We started becoming more. Although Elizabeth Waters Hall, I'm poor on dates, I got to get some of these dates here. Elizabeth Waters Hall opened in 1940, and we had waitress service there for about 2 or 3 years. And then we went to cafeteria service at the girls' request, especially during the week. It was much easier that way for the noon meal. And sometimes Sunday noons we would serve it, but generally speaking, we went to cafeteria service except for parties, banquets, and things like that.
One other thing that Mr. Alverson, I think, mentioned, I'm just trying to recall now, talked about the house fellows at mealtime would sometimes lead discussions with the discussion leaders. Was this a common practice?
In the earlier days, it was, especially. And the houses would have their own tables, and the house fellows would sit at the head of the table. But it became more informal in the 40s, anyhow.
In the 40s. Oh, so that would have continued up through the 30s?
Yes, most of the 30s, I would guess it would, yeah. And I think the key to success was having the halls broken down into small units. And there was a tremendous lot of rivalry in halls, athletics, and all the rest of the things. And they'd have their own parties and go together with one of the girl houses and have a party. And so we had, I don't know if you want dates.
Yes, I do.
I just wanted Chadburn Hall was by far our oldest hall. That was torn down and rebuilt, but it was called Ladies Hall, 1871, I think it was built, and Barnard Hall in 1917. You can have this.
Okay, well, maybe why don't you just give us that then, and we can have that information.
And we went through a tremendous lot of work when we started building new halls. Mm-hmm. And we had, now I'm getting off the subject, I suppose we better get back to the students again. But we had really excellent student workers, and the relationship between the student and Mr. Alverson or myself, or later when I took over, I was Lee and he was Don, and he just loved that sort of thing. And it was better. We ate with the house fellows a lot, and if they had their meetings, and we'd try to eat in a different dining room for dinner every day, just to get to know the kids, and I think the feeling was good.
It's almost like it wasn't a we and they type situation. It was an us type situation.
Yeah.
It was more or less a calculated, not calculated, that sounds so cold, but a part of, you considered it part of your job to eat in the different halls and people.
Yeah.
You weren't just administrators.
When we were ordering furniture, we'd ask, changing furniture or anything like that, we'd ask for a house committee to meet with us and discuss what they thought we should have, and so on, and we'd show them the samples of various things and get their feelings on it, and we were building so much from 38 on, when Crown Sage units were open, and that was a big job. But it worked out real well. And then Elizabeth Waters Hall in 1940 opened. And we were opening a hall for 535 girls all at one time. And that was a rough one. But again, when we had furniture, we got samples of furniture. I worked mostly on the furnishings ends and the kitchen layouts with Don always, but the furniture, we had Leon Fisher, he was our consultant, but we'd get the samples up and have a committee of the girls, their own committee, come and give their comments on it, so that we tried to get as much input from students as we possibly could in the hall, and we hoped that our staff members were very friendly and with all of them. and we didn't have a lot of stuffed shirts around so that they could come and sit down, and the house fellows were really the key to it, because they were close, and we met with them once every week or once every 2 weeks at a meal, and discuss any problems that they had. They didn't like this, and they didn't like that, or if we were changing the telephone systems, which we did. We had telephones in the halls at first, and finally got a telephone in each room, and we'd always discuss it with the student leaders, the presidents of the houses, or if they had a committee. And so I think half the fun of the job was working with the students directly or indirectly through the house fellows and the head residents. And the food, they had some fault with the food. Right? They had a commons committee, and we met with the commons committee in each unit, what they'd like changed, or anything like that. And we had two tremendous chefs, at least, but in Carson Gully and Mrs. Lydia Jones.
Now, Mrs. Jones, wasn't she found out at Glacier?
Didn't
Don Halverson find her when same year he found you?
Yes, and he worked me to get her to come down here. And
he worked you to get her down there?
Yes, sure.
Out at Glacier he did that?
Well, no, after I got here.
Oh.
And he said, boy, oh boy, if we could get that chef. Because we had a chef at the union we weren't too happy with, and we got her down.
So she came several years after he had first met.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And like Carson Kelly, he was a black, and we couldn't find housing. We finally built an apartment for him in the ground or basement floor in Trip Hall. And boy, he was almost worshipped by the students when the football team went to the Rose Bowl. He drove four or five kids out to the Rose Bowl, and he was always going fishing with them and things like that. Well, we all wanted our staff to associate as much as they could with the students and get to know them, and they get to know us. And I think this was Don's. He enjoyed this, and we learned a lot from them. And, I mean, furnishing a student room, we'd always have a committee to work with us, and we'd show them what we had planned and tried it out and everything. And I think this helped the students, and they have a very, very strong student organization in each hall. And the Men's Halls Association, they had a good store out in the basement of Mack House for, you know, knicks and knacks and paper and whatnot, and they made good money on that. Anything that they felt they would like a better place to build things and try to fix them up with the room. And the house fellows, as I say, were really the key in between. And the dean's offices were wonderful with us. Sure, we had our arguments, but they were really high class, and they were on our committees, and they were invited to all the parties and kids gave, I think the majority of the students liked the halls very much, and in their junior and senior years, there'd be a certain number that go to fraternities and sororities, and that was all okay.
Normal.
I mean, and there was rivalry between houses, you know. in the touch football and softball and all the way through. But I think Don's philosophy of getting the students in on as much as possible carried through, and certainly did with me, and I know it did with Noel, and I'm sure it will continue on, because they need a lot of freedom, but they also need a little direction at times, because they came up with some harebrained ideas, and we'd have our water fights occasionally, you know, but the house fellas would get out there and, you know, and pick out the ringleaders, and they'd straighten it out and mop it up, and off they go again.
So, let's talk for a minute about philosophy.
Yep.
Because Mr. Halverson, as you can well imagine, really hit that topic quite heavily, because he was in on those formative years with
right.
the committee, with Slichter and Bradley and Kowalki
and all
those people, based on Van Hise's speech in 1904, 1905, something like that.
Yeah.
When did you start learning about the philosophy of housing here at UW?
Well, I was at the Union, and Don Halverson likewise was at the Union. When they built the Union, the Regents had appointed Porter Butts as the director of the Union, but they wanted somebody to head up the food service and the mechanics of the operation. Porter was tremendous as far as the programming and all of the different student committees and whatnot, but they asked Don to head up the business end of it and the food end of it. And so I was, after I graduated, was offered the assistant steward job, and I had charge of the accounting office, which at the Union was taking care of both the residence halls in the Union, they had some personality problems in there, and we had to clear it out and start it over again. Your question now?
My question was, when did you learn about the philosophy of housing?
Through Don, and I went to a lot of meetings, and I read back through the minutes of...
Was it talked about a lot?
Yes, and at the... It wasn't talked about so much as it was shown.
Practice.
And I mean, at the start of the year, we met with our house fellows for a whole week and just discussed various phases of their simple duties, but most importantly, of getting a house together and helping, listening, and when there was a problem with any student that they couldn't handle, they would go to their head residence in the girls' hall, or the head fellow, and from the head fellow to the director, or assistant director. Ernie Damon was an excellent man on our staff. Then along, of course, came the war, and that was a rough, rough time, because we took in I had been promoted then to the assistant director of residence halls, and the Navy especially.
Oh, we're getting ahead of ourselves.
I'm sorry.
I want to get in. I've got a whole set of questions on your military thing. Go ahead, Steve.
I'd like to, you just mentioned before that when you wanted to look at the philosophy, you know, you read the minutes of some meetings, certain meetings you looked at?
Yeah.
Do you know where specifically?
No, I don't think I have. I suppose they'd be in the files and in residence halls. But I think more than anything else, when you grow up in it and you live in it, you understand what they want. Mm-hmm. And Don had his regular staff meetings, and we all get together and discuss our problems and whatnot. And I was not as close to the student end of it as I was in the administrative, the accounting, the planning, the, and then of course the financial end of it. And then gradually, when I became director, well then I was right in the middle of it, and so I'm with the head residents and the house fellows, and our philosophy, we wanted to be close to the house fellows. We didn't want older people doing as much directing of students. We'd rather have the house fellows, who were good young people and sound in most instances. Sometimes we'd make a mistake. And then we'd have head fellows, and then they would come to us. And we'd meet with the house fellows regularly, once or twice a week. Every week or every 2 weeks. Problems, complaints, anything they heard, their house was having troubles, they had difficulties with people. We had on our faculty committee the director of the student health department, Luke Gold, and the dean of women, dean of men, and their assistants. And then we'd have professors like Professor Kowalki, Dr. Bradley, I mentioned him before, and there were several women, right at the time I can't tell you their names now, but I think I have it in here someplace, but they were people who would help us in problems between the department and the university, give us ideas. And sometimes we'd meet with the director of athletics, Harry Stuhlgraer, and he'd always be helpful. I think the key to it was having good house fellows and giving them training and then giving them responsibilities. Mm-hmm. And we had very few that we had to leave out because they grew up in the halls and they knew what they were supposed to do. We have a few water fights now and then. Then we wanted the students to have a business organization, and they started their own store, and they made good money on the store. They started their own libraries and kept them up, and we wanted them, if they wanted to have parties, to stay on the campus, the union or the halls. And we'd always be ready to use a dining room for a dance and have it fixed up in the morning for breakfast, and they decorated. They'd all help. And once in a while we'd have a young man or young woman who just didn't fit in. And then we would discuss it with the dean of women or the dean of men, and they sometimes had good suggestions, and they'd meet with us. And sometimes we'd have to send them home too, but very few. And we had good relationship. Don was known as Don, and I was known as Lee, and that's the way we wanted him.
I want to talk about one more topic before we'll take a break then, and then we'll get into your associate director and the war, which I'm very interested in, and the immediate post-war years. We said we'd get to this a minute ago, about 20 minutes ago, but you talked about professors. What was there, before you became associate director, in the period of the 30s when you were here, what was their involvement in housing, and who were some of the key figures?
Well, we had the faculty committees, which was one for the women and one for the men.
Mm-hmm.
And the chairman of that was always dean of women and dean of men, or their assistants. And they would appoint the president on recommendation, usually by the director, or the dean of men or the dean of women. Good, interesting faculty members. Kiekhofer was on at one time. And, I mentioned Kowalki, mm-hmm. and the women were in the I'll have to look up and see if I can remember their name. But they were good, very interested faculty members. And they met and would discuss, and Don or I would ask them about any problems at all, what they heard, and who were good house fellow candidates. And we were always looking for
Did they do stuff like things like occasionally stop up for meals?
Oh yeah, like yes. We and the girls especially had a lot of faculty members in for meals.
Who invited them?
We didn't. The students would. We didn't want to get. We wanted the students to have the people they want. We'd make suggestions to the house fellows or the presidents. You know. Gee, so and so is really interested. He's a good ski instructor and whatnot, and they'd go for that. And they had practically all of the full-time professors and their wives over, and the girls especially would always have dinner guests, and on Sundays, and holidays, we wanted the faculty to feel free if they were having trouble with anyone to call one of us, and then we would go to the head resident or house fellow, discuss it with them sometimes. Luke Cole was a great deal of help in the student health department, you know.
Can you remember some of the favorite professors of some of the students who were invited over more often than others?
Yes, I think Kiekhofer was one, and the deans always were favorites.
Troxel.
Goodnight, yes, and later on their successors. And some of the professors were out of the commerce school, law school. I'm trying to think of some of them. They'd always have a lot of fun with them, and they'd invite them to the. I'd like to think a little bit more on some of the names, because my memory isn't as well as it used to be. It's good. I mean, and
lost them all. I'll make them
up. Yes, and then I'll give it. But we wanted them to have outsiders in, and sometimes.
What about Leonard, William Ellery Leonard? Did you know
that? Okay. Well, not very often.
He was kind of an unusual figure.
Yeah, he hung around the Union all the time.
Oh,
he'd be swimming out there, and he was a really strange fellow. But
he sure sounds like. What about Margaret Dobler?
Yeah, she was fine, real good.
Was she around the dorm?
Yes, yes, uh-huh.
I could see her as being.
Yes, yes, she was, I think Margaret Dobler is still living, isn't she?
Well, they're just doing a major biographical biography of her.
Is that right?
I don't know if she's still alive or not, but it's being done by someone in the dance department. It should be coming out. Keep an eye out for it.
Good,
see
yeah.
Something
yeah,
out
yeah,
a year
let's
or so.
Do that. I think she lived in Tucson, didn't she, towards the end? Or
yeah, I don't know.
Or Phoenix, one of them.
I'm just starting to investigate her career here. I don't know anything about
yeah.
what happened afterwards.
She married a younger fellow, a lot younger, as I recall. Well,
getting back to the professors,
yeah.
Aside from meals, what other types of activities might professors have been involved with students in?
Usually for all dances or anything like that, they would invite some couple for as their guests and what you call the chaperones.
Mm-hmm.
The girls especially had a great number of guests. And the house fellows would pick their favorite professors, often invite them for a Sunday dinner or for a party. And they had Dorm Sylvania, you know, a large, their annual big blowout, and that was a big party.
What was it called?
Dorm Sylvania.
Why was it called Dorm Sylvania?
Well, you'll have to ask the student. And man, oh man, they'd take you over like both floors of Carson Gully there, have two orchestras, and it was a real dress up, very fine affair
time.
Yeah. And they had more professors in for an evening meal, their wives, and then go back over to their dens and usually talk, visit for a while, and so that they could get to know them. And there were some that were much more, well, they were very active in the with students, and they had their favorites. Now, again, I'll have to.
Here's another one. Is this one of their favorites? I'm just fishing. Max Otto?
Oh, yes. Oh, Max Otto. And his wife was a peach.
Oh, I don't know anything about his wife.
Yes. Yes, she was a wonderful woman.
I seem to recall, I should have listened to that tape, Steve, that Mr. Halverson talking about teas on Sunday afternoon when faculty were invited. Was that a tradition that was continued for a fairly long time?
Oh, yes, it was.
It was
active
when you
hall.
Came, and
yes.
Did it continue up till?
Oh, yes. They were still having their teas on Sunday. Not every Sunday, but special
yeah.
teas. And
how long did that continue before it pretty much died?
Well, I suppose, I would guess, and in the early 50s.
That long?
Yeah. But during the war years, of course, there was a great upset when we had to move kids out and turn them over to the military, but they were tremendous on that. And there were no major problems.
I want you to comment on one. Do you have questions?
Well, before we get too far away from it, when you came here first as a student, did you live in the residence halls then, under a house fellow?
No, I lived in the Union.
I see. There was student housing in the Union.
No, there was just the top floor of the Commons wing. There were, 12, 15 rooms up there, mostly guest rooms, few professors. And they wanted somebody to live in for a call for emergency. And like, the night watchman used to come up every once in a while. Somebody was so drunk he couldn't get in. Herman Eggstead.
Something's never changed.
Herman Eggstead was trying to kick in the front door. don't mention him. He was the, Eggstead was the alumni director. He was a character, but he lived there, and Porter Butts lived there too for a while just after he was married, and I lived there sort of day and night, seemed to me, for a while, but I lived also right down on Orchard Street here, and I saw it. The old apartment house with Dr. Andias and Johnny Walsh was there for a while, and so we used to have some fun, I tell you.
I want to ask you about two more characters, one serious and one you might get a guffaw over, because Mr. Halverson sure did. The first one, tell me a little bit about George Sellery.
Well,
apparently he fought a little bit against housing.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. And he felt that the business of the university, I think, was the instructional teaching and whatnot. And I don't think Sellery ever realized how much education comes from group living. He was nice. I don't think we ever had many arguments with him, but now Scott Goodnight was very good Dean of Men, you know, and his successors and were very helpful, as were the Dean of Women. But I don't think he was my favorite professor.
He was succeeded as an LNS by Mark Ingram. Was the switch there? Was there a switch?
Well, I think Sellery retired at that time, didn't he?
Was there? How did Ingram treat housing?
Very, very fine. Mark was a good friend of ours. It was always, they were always fighting for funds for. Mm-hmm. For their projects. Well, actually, the Halls never did have much of any subsidy from the general fund. It was, you make it. You got to
earn your own way.
Yeah, you got to earn it when we build. And I think with Mark, there was some agitation when we build in certain locations. Mm-hmm. And but he certainly was fine, and the last time before he died, I stopped and saw him, and he reminded me of when I was head waiter at the Union, and they were having a big banquet, and I went over, I couldn't get a hold of him, to find out just exactly how many there were, and he said that I think it was 502 or something like that, so the next day, he called me and he said, "Lee, how many were there?" And I said, "Well, you're a mathematician, can't you tell me?" He said, 502. And I said, "That's what you're billed for." Yeah, so he was really, had a sense of humor. Yeah. Most people didn't think so, but I think Mark was.
And you had the feeling that he was a little more in agreement with the housing philosophy as opposed to Dean Sellery.
Yes. Well, Sellery just didn't, he wasn't much interested in it, I'm sorry to say, I don't think. Yeah. At least, that wasn't my impression. And all of the Dean of Men and Dean of Women we had were very friendly. They were on our faculty committee, and of course, we worked with them very closely. When we had serious problems, they would get involved the same way. Lou Cole at the student clinic, and he was one of the original house fellows, I think.
Let's talk about him for just one second, and then I promise we'll take a break. Was he in charge of psychiatric physician services?
He was in charge of the student health department.
Student health department. When, to your best of your recollection, did the student psychiatric services begin? I'm trying to trace that down and having a little trouble.
I don't know, but we sure would refer him over there, and there were, oh man, again, you know, my memory isn't what it should be. But there are, they handled some very difficult problems and were always very helpful. There was Washburn, Annette Washburn. Helped a great deal on problems.
On mental problems.
Yes. Either men or women. I think she was better with them, with the fellows than she was with women. All
oh, was she? Washburn was a she.
Yes,
I didn't realize that.
Yes, she was really, and she was on our faculty committee for a while, which was good.
How long did your faculty committee go on?
Oh, golly, you went there.
Is that still going? That
I imagine so. The new one. Well, but our faculty committee was until I left, was still functioning, and they would, it was good. I mean, here they could see things, you know, and call our attention to problems as far as studies are concerned. We had a good family. We had a good staff. Don was tremendous that way. He made you work like hell, but he'd give you responsibility, and he didn't interfere. If something went wrong, it was you, and he'd tell you what you did wrong, and that was all right.
I just noticed one more topic that we may have to cover real quickly. Again, I promise to turn off after this and take a break. Before we get to 1937, there was a little thing that happened in the United States of America during the early 30s, mid-30s, called the Depression.
Yes.
What kind of an effect did the Depression have on housing? And
it was real tough. It was real tough. And we made no money. We kept the rates just as low as we could. And the halls were pretty well filled, though. But then I was at the union at the time, and the banks all closed, and people didn't have any money. And so Don says, well, let's issue these chits, and so that people can borrow them, use them, and then it pays back eventually. Well, we got in a little trouble with the business office about doing it without getting clearance, but we did it, and we got paid back everything there. And it was tough going, and I mean our staff was cut thin. I was at the union at that time, the business office there, and it was damn tough. And the dorms were not as full as they normally were. Normally there was always filled and waiting list. And we were paying 35 cents an hour for student helpers, you know, that was too much. But it was a couple of rough years. And but we never closed any halls.
Oh, you never did?
No.
Was that one of the things that induced you to come to Wisconsin, by a job here, and during those rough times?
Well, I don't want to mention the school I went to in Minnesota. I didn't enjoy it at all. And then I spent at Glacier Park, spent a year out west, San Francisco, and with a kid, a young fellow who wanted to go to Wisconsin, and I did too. And that's why I really was interested in Wisconsin.
So you were interested in Wisconsin even before you met Mr. Helms?
Yes, very much so.
It wasn't a very tough sell that he had.
No, no, not at all. I should say not. I was very, very happy to get there. And those were tough years, though, at the Union, I'm telling you. And the residence hall is the same way. And there were lots of vacancies. But they managed to pay their amortization on schedule. We never got behind. But golly, students were 30 cents. We had meals at the Union for 35 cents specials, 30 cents specials, you know. And we had to cut back a great deal. And many students, well, we had less students, of course, but they were good sports about it, seems to me. But they were.
Was there a kind of solidarity to pull together, like the Depression was here and we're all in the same boat?
Well, we've always had a pretty good student government, at least while I was here, and they helped in some areas, but they gave up proms, I think, and things like that. They'd have hard time parties, you know, come dressed in overalls and so on, and they took it well, but there were a lot of kids that had to go home because they just couldn't pay anything at all. And as far as any bills were concerned with students, we didn't have any that we never collected from. They paid for 2, 3, 4 years, some of them. But we didn't.
So you did extend like a sort of credit then to the students to allow them, like when they got out of school and got a job, to pay you back?
Yes.
Was this okay by the business office?
Yes. But we had to be darn careful about it. We didn't do it an awful lot of it. We did it for some. And because we just didn't know where we were going, and then of course the war years were rough too. When we get into those were the...
We're going to get into those in just...
Why don't we begin this part with a general overview of your career at UW from 1937 on.
Well, in 37 I was promoted to assistant director of residence halls. The halls were expanding. We were getting ready to build there, and the Union Theater was being built. And so Porter had a big job with that, and we were, I went with the residence halls, and they were badly needed, and as assistant director, I thought there was greater opportunities ahead for me in the management of a large department than feeding and housing and the construction of... We were just starting on the construction of Elizabeth Waters Hall and the Cronsage units, and I assisted in the plans and the furnishings and the equipping of the new halls. We had a building committee done. And I planned out the kitchen and the serving plans, and working very closely with the state architect's office. And we had a student and a staff committee. We were assisted interior decorator from Whitewater, a good friend, Leon Pacheret, and I just felt that I would enjoy that work more than in the union work, much as I had enjoyed that. And state architect, I worked closely with them, and then also the purchasing department, and working on the furniture, equipment, and the layouts, and the whole deal there. And Don and I worked, and I learned an awful lot in that field. And we operated two cooperative houses, Susan Davis and Zoe Bayless, for cooperative living girls. I think they're still on. Mm-hmm. And then also the two men, Schreiner and Bauman houses. Here again, these are pretty much self-contained, and they were considerably less costly as far as living was concerned, with the kids doing most of the work. It was a lot of fun. But then came World War II, and we had Before that, we had the Elm Drive grouping. We had replanned the Chadburn, and then later on the southwest area of the Gordon, Celery, Hog, and all those, and worked very closely with the on the planning and the purchasing, and a lot of time with the state purchasing department there. And I enjoyed that sort of work. And then came World War II, and the request from the federal government for assistance, and Dykstra was the president at that time, and Al Peterson, A.W. Peterson, was the comptroller and the business manager of the university, and they first requested housing, feeding, and instructional space for 1,800 Navy personnel. And boy, oh boy, we had some tall moving around to do. Students took it real well. We had to clear out certain halls. And the first request was for 1,200 Navy radio personnel. And the regents quickly passed legislation for the director residence halls to negotiate for any off-campus rentals of facilities. And as assistant director and director, Don and I, and another young man, Vic Bringy, assisted in the rental of all the facilities we could. And the fraternities were closing up, you know, and they didn't have enough in. Sororities were fuller, but we got most of the fraternity houses. And then we had both the arrangements for the housing and the food service for the trainees. Some of the ones down on Langdon Street, we served at the union, but then they pushed us more and more. Dykstra appointed Don Alverson as chairman of the Emergency Housing Committee, and with Zoe Bayless, the Office of Dean of Women, and Blanche Stammer, the Housing Bureau, and Dean of Men, and there were two students to assist in any problems they could and be available for feelings. And actually, this committee was very helpful in making available housing food facilities. Don was shifted to Associate Director of Business and Finance, and I was made Director of the War Housing Office, and working very closely with the above project. That was 1942, and directly with the military staff on feeding. And boy, I had a large map of the university area and the Langdon Street area, and mapped out where all the houses were, and we took over the fraternity houses, cleaned them out, refurnished them, you know, and served many of them at the union. And then took over, Joe Camp was a young man, been a house fella, and was not, they couldn't pass the medical standards for the Army or the Navy, and he did a good job with working with the Housing Committee, and gradually, we had up and down Langdon Street, I don't know how many houses now, and we had practically all of the fraternity houses. And this is just between us, but they were the last parties he held were really dillies. Oh boy, we had housing, we had a real job cleaning some of those up and getting them all. And we had quite a few of the fraternity houses. Practically all of the Crown Siege houses were reserved for the Air Force and the Navy. And for the next year, we had one house at 615 North Henry Street for kids that we had to move out of the dorm. And we rented it, and sort of as a cooperative house, and they named it Halburn House after Don and me. And it was used for 3 years, but it was really hard, you know, to get a place to live in those days with the number of Army and Navy personnel that we had in here. And during 2 years, a contingent of the Air Force were stationed in Gilman and Mack House of the Crown Siege Units. Captain Hastings, his staff fitted well with the Navy group, and many of the university staff were invited to the graduation exercises every kind of bunch that went. And we had real good commanders here, fellows like Commander Schubert and Pollard of the Navy, Captain Hastings of the Air Force. And their non-commissioned officers were most cooperative, and they loved our food in the hall. And the Navy in 1942 requested the university to set up a Navy Cooks and Bakers School. And they, as I said, were very impressed with the Wisconsin Food Service. And the last group was, we had 42, 43, and I think a few in 44, but they were directly supervised by a former hospital dietitian, Mrs. Helen Giese. I think Giese was the, her husband was the business or the finance officer up in the state capital budget director. And suddenly, in August 1942, the Navy requested space for 470 women personnel, WAVES, and also some Coast Guard women. And a hectic month or two followed, with the Dean of Women's Office assisting to relocate the university girls.
So the university people would move out to other houses.
That's right.
The military personnel would get the prime.
Well,
or the dorms.
That's right. And also, we were interested in saving the fraternities and sororities. Mm-hmm. And you see, fraternities especially, they were all drafted like the rest of the people practically, and so we took over. A lot of the fraternity and sorority houses, because there just weren't enough civilian people still going. Mm-hmm. And we had WAVES here, and the communication school was established with the Navy, and the problem of employment was constant as far as we were concerned. They were warm and could walk, we'd hire them. It was almost like that. And
it wasn't hard to get a job as a student.
No, full-time people too. We had mostly older people to work. And in December 1942, there were 50 civilian pilot training, mainly Marine and pilot training, and Navy and the Marines were housed and fed in the halls. In 1943, three more fraternity houses were taken over. Group after group came for training. 350 meteorologists, Army, Air Force. And you see, they used the staff of the people here, mm-hmm. and that was a strong staff. And we had them in the Crown Siege units, four houses of the Crown Siege units. And a young group of ASTR, what were they, Army?
Service training.
Arrived. The three Badger Club houses in Sterling Court were taking over for that program, ASTR. I don't know if they're still there down in Badger Court. There were three cooperative houses down there. And we took those over and fed them in Chadburn and Barnum, Chadburn dining room also.
Did you then rent these from like the fraternity? Did you pay the fraternity?
Yeah.
A specific rent per month or per year?
Yeah.
Did the military pay on
but
any
they,
rent?
They paid us. Mm-hmm.
The military paid you?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And so the military took care of their expenses. We submitted and they did all right, I think. The ASTR were reservists, 17-year-olders. Later on, we got a bunch of those in the Crown Siege group for about a year. So it went on constantly, coming and going. Navy was our biggest group. And during the latter part of 43 into 44, I was sick. I had, God only knows what, I don't know, but I had surgery here in Madison and then went up to Rochester. And boy, I was up there for 6 months. And it was hell back. For Don and the crew back there, but things were winding down somewhat then. In June 45, Don left residence halls to become associate director of business finance. It was April 28th and 45 that I became director of residence halls until I retired. But these hectic years during the war truly showed what an excellent staff and an outstanding crew that residence halls had. And nothing was too difficult to handle. My gosh, we worked midnight many times getting ready. Many hours of overtime and loyalty to the university in the United States, certainly from our workers, showed up with great honors, we thought. And we enjoyed working with them, but we worked like hell, and our students bore an awful lot of hardships as far as moving is concerned and getting ready for this and that. And yet, very gripe seemed to me that we had from the students. I mean, they knew the reasons and they went right along with it. And immediately after the war...
Let's can we go back over the war years for just a couple minutes? They're fascinating. So what you had is you had the situation where most of the males on this campus were leaving.
Right.
And you had the military requesting space without any forewarning necessarily for anywhere from 20 people to 1,500 or something like that. And you were expected to maybe within a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks or whatever the timeline provide housing in dormitory space for these people.
And
feed them.
Yes.
Well, that's an amazing situation.
And Cook's training course. My gosh, we set up a training course for cooks and bakers. And gee, was we had, I forget how many in here, I've got it someplace I know. This was wonderful for the Navy. They just thought it was great. And boy, every time we graduated a group, boy, they'd have brass come up from Great Lakes, and they made a good deal of it. And we had people like Carson Gully, who was a color chef, and Mrs. Jones, and our staff of dietitians. And boy, oh boy, I'm telling you, we trained them.
So Carson Gully and Mrs. Jones were trainers?
Well, yes.
Teachers were on that
side. Actually, here was just the training and safety officer that I was, and here was the training courses that we used, and really, we trained so many people, and then we got into training afterwards, mm-hmm. and I think you can just take a look at it there. Yeah, that you can.
I think what we'll do is maybe after the interview, we'll go through the documents.
Yes. Yeah.
With
okay.
your permission,
yeah,
perhaps.
Sure.
Yeah. You talked also about the relations between the university community and the military community. Could you go into a little more detail on that? How was it?
It was good. We had never any uprisings or anything like that. There'd be some grumbling sometimes when they got kicked out to go someplace else, but when we did it, it didn't seem to.
Now, between administration and officer, it seemed to be pretty good. I remember Mr. Halverson talking about a green guy.
Oh,
his face still turns red when he talks about Mr. Green.
He was terrible. But we had generally really good military people.
The relations between the university and the military community. We talked about officers and administrators. What about students and soldiers?
Never had any uprisings, any arguments, or anything like that.
Is there a lot of fraternization between?
Not much.
Not much.
No, and they kept the Army Navy groups together and so damn busy that I don't know if they.
They had time for
anything else.
A lot of drinking or anything like that. No. Were they, obviously, if they were a very visible force on campus,
oh,
did they do their parading, marching, and things like that?
Out on the athletic fields.
And when they went to classes, they went to classes in uniforms?
They went to class in uniforms.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there was a real, obvious, several visible distinctions between them.
Oh, yes, yeah. But there didn't seem to be any hard feelings at all. I mean, we never had, they grumbled a little bit. God, why do we have to move out of here and go down so-and-so house, some fraternity house or something like that? Mm-hmm. But they understood. I don't think we had any general uprising at any time with any of the military people.
You talked for a bit about the fraternities moving out, a lot
yes.
of them were drafted, taking over the houses. And the sororities did the same?
No.
They stayed in their houses?
They stayed in their houses.
So it was just the fraternities that
it was fraternities, yeah.
We talked before about the philosophy, and you shared it with us on student decision-making and involvement in housing, et cetera, et cetera. How did that survive during these war years? Did the house fellowship stay intact at all with people off campus?
Yes. No, not with people off campus, but any of the houses that we had. Not as house fellows, they call them just presidents of houses. And we rented it to them and took care of it. And we had I don't think we call them house fellows. But in many of the houses, we had Yeah, we had house fellows for the women,
mm-hmm.
but not for the men.
Right.
And then the women and the head residents still watched very closely after all the houses. We had to remove like all of the ones out of Barnard and Chadburn Hall.
Mm-hmm.
We did the best we could. There was no hard feelings. I mean, I'm sure there were disappointments, but we never had any sort of an uprising or showing or complaints that they were taking care of this or that or the other thing.
So if I can summarize, and you can correct me, during the war years then, in terms of the philosophical basis of how the students off campus, those placements, they're pretty much on their own as they are today, living away from campus. But on campus, the girls' dorms pretty much stayed as they were with the house fellow concept. The boys' dorms changed slightly in terms of names, but the general day-to-day operations didn't change all that much?
Well, they had a different... The boys had... It was different with the fellows in
there. Let's go through that again. I'm not quite sure I understand how it was different.
I don't know exactly if I can explain it. We certainly didn't have any association with the... they didn't have any house fellows. They had what they call the house fellows. The Navy had... we had lieutenant commanders. Yeah, and they had their platoons and they had their squad leaders and what they call them in the Army, the Navy. But it was all handled by the Navy and it's below a lieutenant, ensigns and...
It was all by rank, petty officers,
yeah,
petty corporals,
officers, yeah.
Sergeants.
Yeah.
All this was all, and we all had...
And we worked directly through the top men, like Commander Green sometimes.
Fair's the thought.
But Schubert was tremendous, and actually we had good relations with him. But you never knew, you know. One day, all of a sudden, they'd say, we're sending up 250 people, where are you going to take care of them? And Al Peterson was the business manager, and Don was his assistant. And by golly, some way or another, we'd make changes, and even the union had the dances and parties over there for them and for the Rotskeller, and the Pine Room was hangouts for the petty officers but the students never, to my knowledge, I think they were upset that they had to move and like that, but they never made any outside complaint or never any article on the Cardinal when it ran was unfavorable towards the military. And we were fortunate. We had some real good, Schubert was a tremendous guy, and the Army man was swell that we worked with. But we had a few that we, like Green and one other guy that came here and expected the university to provide a fancy home for them out in Maplewood. A couple like that, but the majority of them were down-to-earth people.
Do you have any problems with discipline, like between the services? Was there rivalry, fighting, let's say, between Army, Navy, Air Force?
No.
Like when not off duty at the Roscoe, there was?
Oh, yeah, once in a while. Not at the... You'd hear of a brawl downtown if they had you know, in some tavern or something like that, but not too often. And they had their chief petty officers that were watching over them pretty well.
Did you have a contingent of, they call military police, MPs on campus?
Yes.
To take care of such things?
They handled military matters and Madison police handled student matters?
That's right.
One more question about the students who were remaining in dorms at that time throughout the war years now. Did the faculty continue to do pretty much of what they had done before the war years in terms of eating a lot at the houses, and did anything change?
Well, there weren't many halls that housed students during those years.
So students were mainly off campus at this point.
And down very low, of course.
And down because of the
enrollment, that's right.
So your job, I guess, was probably more in finding the military housing and taking care of those.
Really, it was much more so, yeah.
Okay, so if Steve was writing a little outline of the history of housing,
yeah,
you wouldn't say that housing stopped during this period, certainly, because
no,
there was still housing on campus, but you would say that the shift in emphasis in the war years was on providing housing for the military personnel.
Housing and
who
feeding.
Who you never knew when they were coming yet.
No. Well, they try to give us a little notice. But
how much notice did you usually get?
Oh, maybe a week.
Did you ever get a call saying we're sending 400 down the day after tomorrow?
Yes. And we put them in the stadium.
Intense?
No.
Intense?
No, they were just enclosing the stadium on this side. And they had a couple of rooms up in there that we would, but we'd have to take care of the feeding of them.
So you'd say, get your sleeping bags and stuff, you're going to sleep
on
the floor until we can find you something?
Yeah.
And how long would they normally stay, the groups?
Well, for the Navy, it usually was 3 months. I think 12 weeks would be about the maximum.
Mm-hmm.
Then a new group would come in.
Mm-hmm. So it's a constant turnover.
Yeah,
And it might not be the same group replacing the other group.
No.
The same type of situation.
But more so. We had by far the most Navy.
Yeah. Was this, what happened here pretty much standard on university campuses around the country?
Yes, in the Big Ten, anyhow.
In the Big Ten.
Yeah, yeah. Because I know Indiana used to call up and say, this is off the record, she was a large, what did we call her? Anyhow, Big Ten group has always been close together, but she'd call up and she'd say, Lee, what the hell do you do when the goddamn Navy sends in 1,200 more people? I says, we take care of them. Well, it's, they give you short notice, but they all had them. They had, and it was good for us too, because after all, I imagine we would have had a lot of empty halls at those times. And the fraternities, certainly, we helped a good deal.
Was there a general feeling of patriotism on campus from
yeah.
the faculty and staff and students on these people being here?
Generally, they were well accepted.
Yeah.
And the Rod Skeller in the Pine Room, gosh, I know I met a couple of, what would they call them, military police or in the Navy in Chicago when I was down
Shore
there,
Patrol.
And they said, Shore Patrol. They'd say, what the hell are you doing? You should be at the Pine Room, shouldn't you? And so they took care of their own people.
So during the off hours, though, like on a Friday night, for example, you could see soldiers and students down at the Rod Skeller.
Oh, yeah.
Or you could see soldiers and students at the Log Cabin on State Street.
Right.
Or at the pub or something like
Pine
that.
Pine Room, too.
Pine Room, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So the fraternization could occur during the off hours, but
not during the working hours. But there were very few fights between
mm-hmm.
civilians and them.
Mm-hmm.
Very often you'd have a couple of Navy guys go to it, or
mm-hmm.
they get too much beer or someone like mm-hmm. that, but that was normal. And we had really a fine group, generally speaking, and the Air Force group with Captain Hastings, meteorologist, had Gilman and Turner House and Mack House, And oh boy, he had them under his thumb, and I'm telling you, they really worked hard. And
when the groups left, what type of shape did they leave the dorms in?
Well, there was an awful lot of wear and tear on the place, but in general, we'd have our crew go in and clean it up and be ready for the next one.
Like that frat house after their last
blowout. With the Navy, we were never sure when somebody was coming, when they pulled some group out and whatnot. Maybe 2 days' notice. And then we'd get in and clean up the place and be all set for them. But we worked like hell during those years. And I tried, and they offered me a... I wouldn't put it in the record. They offered me a senior grade lieutenant. And I went down to Great Lakes, but I couldn't pass the physical. And that's when I ended up in Rochester. But they were really very cooperative with the university. And I don't think that they were rowdy or anything like that, and they liked our meals very much. And we had a training group for cooks and bakers, which helped us too. And we continued. Actually, I got real interested in training employees after seeing how they did it. And I was training officer for the university the residence halls after I retired as director for quite a few years. And I'm telling you, I think that training is a key to institutional management that hasn't been emphasized enough. But there were hectic years during that war but we had a loyal staff.
One more question. In the houses, you said that pretty much soldiers, Navy might be in one house, student women might be in another, girls, Army another. Were there situations where they would be shared, or was that pretty much avoided entirely?
No, it was avoided.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm pretty satisfied with the war years. I have a real good feeling. Steve, how about you?
I have no questions.
Okay, why don't you continue with your narrative then?
All right. As I said, that it was in 45 that Mr. Halvorsen left residence halls to become associate director of business finance, and then I became director of residence halls until I retired. And I can't speak enough for the loyal staff that we had during the war, and the hours of overtime and loyalty to the university and the military. Certainly our staffs and workers deserve a lot of honor, and our students bore the hardships, the moves, the changes, with really hardly ever a gripe or a moan or anything like that. But immediately after the war, and I'm changing, and especially the university, I think, faced one of the greatest crises as far as housing was concerned, because we had a great influx of returning veterans, you know, whose education had been interrupted, and so negotiating with the Army and the Navy and the Federal Housing Commission, the men in bureaus in Washington, was tedious. But Al Peterson and Don Halvorsen were darn good at it, and President Fred too was very forceful, helpful, and 1945, when word came, it was in December, that a section of Truax Field was turned over to the university. Yeah, we got the base hospital out there and three large housing or classroom buildings, which we changed over into housing. And they were released to the university, and I was director of housing at that time. And I just moved out there and headed up the situation at the time. And then Newell Smith got out of the Army, and boy, he was a great help. And we made him manager of the Truax Field project out there. And Larry Halley was placed in charge of the Badger Village. We had these people coming to the university and no place to house them. Many were married students, and we first also put up trailer camps. We had trailers at Camp Randall and Monroe Park across here. We had about 250 of them there. And East Hill Farm, we had a trailer camp out there, pretty much where the Midvale
Hilldale Shopping Center
is there now. And Ainer Anderson, Merle Jackson were our maintenance men. And boy, if there was any time that we worked hours and hours and overtime, it was after and the return back to take care of the veterans and their married, their families. Cabin Court, we made a little outfit where Jenny Justice used to be back there. We got a spot and could move in some trailers in there.
Who is we?
Well, I was the director of housing, and Newell Smith was one of my assistants.
So you looked for places to
do? Oh, yeah,
Did you have a committee that you worked with, too?
No.
Was it pretty much catch as can?
Al Peterson and Don Halverson certainly helped as far as getting Truax Field and Badger Village.
So you'd look and you'd see cabin courts and you'd say, let's get something there
right away.
And then you'd contact them.
And they would work out
who would build it. Was it private contractor, or were there campus people doing the building?
Well, we had both.
Both?
We had both, but we had to go private because the buildings and grounds was so doggone busy, although they helped a great deal. But we also had to have some there. And the toughest part of all was for married student housing, as you might expect. And I don't know if you've read the Susan Davis, the veteran's wife.
It's in the archives, and I've looked at it. I gave you the first page of that.
Yeah, so I haven't seen it.
Yeah.
Steve will be reading it very carefully.
And that was in, well, let's see. Newell was manager of the Truax Field project, and Larry Halley was up at Badger Village. Now that's, you know, where that is, where the Hercules plant was. And then we ran buses back and forth from both places to the campus. And to get buses through the Army and the Navy, Army I mean, was hell, but we got them from all over the country. And
You got buses requisitioned them through the Army?
Yeah. Yeah. And the trailer camps out here at Randall, Monroe Park, and we just worked day and night. That was one of the worst, hardest times I think we ever had. But we wanted a place where they could live, the returning veterans. And this Badger Village, boy, oh boy, we had one kid, he went with the CIA. We had quite a few hospitals that went with the CIA after. And he headed up the bus business. And, the buildings and grounds helped. And their head mechanic helped handle the bus problems. And, well, it's kind of interesting if you want to read part of this, but that was a busy, busy time for the university. I spent a lot of time with the Public Housing Administration, the Office of the Transportation Corps, trying to get furniture, equipment, and buses in Chicago, Great Lakes, and Al Peterson and Don Albertson did a marvelous job with the federal officials. It was a difficult time for our staff, and I say I can never forget the cooperation that we received from the staff. And that veterans, Susan Davis wrote, she used to be one of our house head residents, and then assistant dean, and she wrote that. And it's quite interesting, I think, if you read it. In the meantime, University Residence Halls were going at full capacity, and we had house fellows, both men and women, same as before. We had some veterans, some younger men, of course, and women. These war veterans, and they were an outstanding group for us and for the young people too. They come in and they didn't split up. They took charge pretty well, as many of them were house fellows. And throughout the war years and after, well, I couldn't imagine a more understanding, more helpful group for our students. It was really a great experience for our younger staff, a gratifying one for our older staff. Our head residents in the women's halls were wonderful, and our men and women house fellows seemed to understand an awful lot of very difficult problems, which returned veterans. There were real problems, you know. They had gone through a lot, and the student health department with was great. He was on our faculty committee, and but that transportation with the buses was a rough one, and but we get some of these Army or Navy men, Army men who had been in the Corps, and they really went to town.
Did you employ then some of the former veterans, say, that lived out at Badger Village to help repair the buses or keep them in running order, or
actually
use them as drivers? Or
drivers we did. At Buildings and Grounds, Garage, their head mechanic, took over the repair of the
Army head mechanic. Okay.
No, the Buildings and Grounds.
Oh, I see.
We kept them running. I don't know how the hell they did it, but this one guy we had was just marvelous. It had scheduling them and through bad weather, good weather, why they'd come on time, and we never had any accidents up Badger Village. With Newell in charge of Truax project, and we included two cafeterias. We ran them out there. We got a lot of help. And then Larry Halley, in charge of Badger Village, was And that was a big project up there, running buses back and forth and setting up a nursery up there. President Fred, Mrs. Fred went up sometimes weekends just to visit with the returning veterans.
Now, was Badger Village, was that all vets?
Yes.
And married as well as?
Yes.
Okay, so those most married veterans?
They were all married.
Okay, what about Truax? That was?
They were mostly married.
Veterans.
All of them, yes.
Yeah. So the regular dorms were pretty much the regular
undergraduate students.
And the other special places were all for veterans?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And
was this done deliberately to separate the veterans, say, from the regular undergrads, especially the single veterans?
The single veterans could live in the dorms.
So these were all just married housing?
This was married housing,
yeah.
Because it was impossible to get a place. You know, right down here in Camp Randall, and we had trailers all over that area there. And some buildings were moved into, you know, for temporary classrooms around. So it was a wild time there. The East Hill Farm Trailer Project, we had a big flood out there. They had a terrific rainstorm and the drainage wasn't right. Oh, I remember I went out there with my boots and we had a boat out there, but they all seemed to live through it. And we had a good staff. The house fellows were, I think we had maybe more veterans, house fellows, than non-veterans. And they were understanding.
Did that, having veteran house fellows and having vets in the dorms, did that change the whole flavor of the vets from the pre-war?
Not particularly. Really, they fit in better than I could have imagined. And there was no feeling or never any uprising between the groups. Oh, sure, we'd have some veterans, sick veterans, and that sometimes wouldn't just fit in, but we'd have to remove them. But and they were busy, and they came back, and they were going to the university for a real thing. And freshmen and the mixture of men and the social programs with the mixture of the mature veteran groups and the regular students seemed to work very well. Some of them, there were meetings that the veterans had, but they were all, we mixed them together. We did not separate the single students there. And it was one busy time.
You treated them at the UW Health Service and treated some of the veterans or some of that you had for like shell shock, whatever horrors they had gone through.
Yes, the psychiatry department was very, very busy at that time. But there were, really, the veterans were so mature. And unless they had some unusual experience, well, I don't think we had any more trouble than.
That's why I guess I was kind of asking that question, if it had changed, because it would seem that being through a war would make a person a different person than an 18-year-old freshman coming in from Chilton, Wisconsin, or something
well,
like that.
Well, it was amazing how, I must say, the majority of the veterans were married or became married very quickly. That's why we had such a tremendous push on the married housing.
Making up for four lost years.
That's right. They'd come back and they'd get married and come to the university, and where are they going to live? Well, somewhere or another we found places for most of them, and of course the city of Madison did a real good job too in helping out there. But the During the war years, we tried to, President's Halls tried to send the newsletters as much as we could, or right after that, and so that people knew where they were. I think I've got copies here someplace. But we sent them, and I think it was appreciated a great deal. The House Fellow Group, those that had been here, why? Like this was later on.
Did the idea for Eagle Heights then come out of this need for married student housing? Did you find
faculty housing and married student housing? Yes. Very much so. The buildings and grounds department and physical plant built the first married student housing out there and ran them. They didn't build them. I mean, they were WARF, W-A-R-F, built them, financed them, and buildings and grounds handled them for a while, but then transferred them to us. And so we had one of our staff brought there, Fritz. He's still in town here. I'll think of his name in a minute. Was our first housing director, our manager out there. And then the university built more married student housing out there, but faculty got the first preference out there.
To live out there?
Yes. And faculty veterans, and there were a lot of them. And then the tent colony, we didn't have anything to do with that. Buildings and grounds had tent colony out there.
This was on the Eagle Heights grounds, out towards Picnic Point.
Picnic Point, in the base of Picnic Point, out there. But we endeavored to send out a newsletter to all of our former House Fellows and staff, like we did there, and just to keep them informed. And it was a rough time right after the war, opening up to Icefield, Badger Village, getting all these trailers, and we worked day and night there. And in October 1954, I resigned because of health problems as director, and Newell became director. And after a 6 months rest, vacation, my interest and love for University Halls, I returned and remained until I retired in 76. And I worked as a part-time consultant with Newell as director. And I worked mainly in the training field, setting up programs for better training of employees. And it was a time when a lot of employees were being added to our staff, and for almost all classes of employees, we had a good tradition as far as working arrangements were concerned, but we had never really set up as good training programs as we should. I was a chairman, along with the Penn State fellow, of the training committee for the Association of American College Housing Officers. And our training programs for chefs, cooks, housekeepers, maids, janitors were all, that's what I worked on mainly, setting up good training programs for them. And we believe it helped the division maintaining high standards. And I think from a food standpoint, we have had excellent food. And Don Halverson was one that set good standards as far as food. And he, of course, had retired. He was in the business office and then later retired. So that much of my time and efforts in my work with the university and with residence halls was largely in the field of administration and operations and supervising the accounting officer and working on budgets. But I think it was the philosophy in the housing area that was really the thing that held our department together. And we worked like hell, but Don was a keystone really in setting up as far as the house fellow and the organization. And we were real interested in students and what they were doing. If they wanted a store, why, we'd help them. And they have had, I don't know if it's still running now.
Yes, it is.
It is, MacAuliffe store. And we were always willing to cooperate with them if they wanted to set one of their basement rooms up for barbell club or anything like we'd go along. And there were the choice of the young men and women to serve as house fellows was we wanted the smaller units, mm-hmm. and so that you'd have 40 or 50 together, so that they'd get to know each other easily. They'd have a house fellow to go to. They had their own student government. I don't know how much money the Vince Halls Association has now, but they had real high kind of financial success in their stores and their other things there.
Getting back to the house fellow thing for a second.
Yeah.
After World War II, you know, we had this kind of, World War II almost didn't count in housing because of all these other things that were happening with the soldiers and everything. Did the selection process remain the same after the war as it had been before the
yes.
war? Did the decision, did the focus on student decision making and that whole aspect, did that remain the same, return to the same?
Yes, it did.
Did, in a talk with Merle Curry, John,
we tried hard.
Yeah. Know. In a talk with Merle Curry that John Jenkins and I had several months back, we asked him to list the most significant change in the university in the pre-war and, you know,
yeah.
the modern university. He said that he's thought a lot about it. And the main variable seems to be size. You know, the size of the university
yeah.
just changed things so radically. What effect did the size of the university have on housing in the post-World War II years?
Oh, boy. Well, and I mean, of course, the married student
mm-hmm.
became much, much more important for a while mm-hmm. there. And the mixture of the veterans and the other ones really didn't matter much, except the veterans, they didn't enter into as much of the extracurricular activities as the younger students. But I don't know. I think the house idea stuck with us, with the veterans and all. And there was not the participation that there were with the younger students. And so I guess, although we never separated, said that this was for veterans and this was for that, there was a tendency for groups to to be together for a while, but it didn't last long.
And the younger students were perhaps more cautious.
They were cautious, and they were following rather than leading quite as much.
And probably in awe of people that had been through what they had done.
Yes, and but we never had rough feelings between the groups. Occasionally, mm-hmm. and you know, some of the veterans needed medical help too, and when they came out of some real rough war experiences. But most of our house fellows after the war were veterans in the men's halls, and they really were fellows like Tell Yell, and many of them. Well,
did food service remain pretty much the same after the war?
Yes.
Did you have the same great cooks that you had before the war, like Carson Gully and
Mrs.
Jones?
Yeah. Here was a training course for cooks. And we had even during the war and then after the war, we had cook trainees and chef trainees. And boy, when they graduated, we'd have a big party and we'd invite the president of the university sometimes and favorite professors in there. But I think as far as the difference, the marriage, we had so many married students, we concentrated heavily on them, you know, for a while. But if their veteran was single, why, he went right to the end of the regular halls. And although I think they were more likely to be looking for apartment spaces than there were halls, and so I think we still were predominantly undergraduates.
What about that same question I've asked before about the role of the professor and how they, did they come around as much as, did the professors come around on the average as much in 1948 as they did in 1932? To eat at the dorms and to talk to the students and have teas and that type of thing?
Well, the women's halls, they certainly did. The men's halls, probably not quite as much. But it didn't take many years, you know.
Yeah.
After that, they got settled fairly normal. The veterans and the younger men were going along. We were fortunate. We didn't have any. Oh, I guess when did the panty raid thing go on once in a while? But that was before.
Why don't you finish your narrative there, and then I have some questions that are kind of unrelated to anything we've been talking about thus far.
Well, let me go on here. Just as a, I repeat, I'm sure, the philosophy of the department, as has been more likely outlined by Don Halverson, was the keystone of any success. Students we wanted to be treated as young men and young women. We didn't baby them. And I mean, they were given an atmosphere to develop their thinking of. Well, we wanted the students to be treated as young men and young women, and they were given an atmosphere to develop their thinking as young men and women. And the house fellow system, in my estimation, is the greatest. And the smaller house units is the choice of young men and young women to head up as house fellows. Give them a middle part to play so that they can work with these young kids was almost unheard of in many universities. But people like Don Halverson, Dr. Bradley, Otto Kowalki, the deans of men and women, really liked the idea of the house and the participation of students in activities, operations, and so on. I won't go into the philosophy of the house fellow system and the fellow system, but I'm sure Don covered it real well. But I can only say that the friendly atmosphere of the halls made the job of directing a real pleasure. I was always called Lee, and it wasn't a formal arrangement here, and we had a head resident who got a little out of line. Well, we talked with them, and we would want them to be right in with the students, and we had a great group of house fellows. I retired in 76 and married my dear wife, and I sure miss it, but I emphasized heavily in the years that I served as director was in good management, training and instructions of employees and supervisors, and it was important for us to have good leadership, both in the and good adequate training for the staff and employees, student supervisor, and the educational staff. First of all, we set up with the training program in the fall of the year, and with the dean of men, dean of women, and with educational staff, like our head residents, we were determined then to concentrate on the food and housekeeping of supervisors first, and then we got a lot of cooperation from the School of Business, training by Russ Momerly and Dick Sullivan. Well, what did they call it?
Institute of Management?
Yeah.
Something.
I went over to them.
Sullivan Hall's named after Dick Sullivan.
Yes. I went over to ask them if we could take advantage of their management program. And they said they had never had a university department ask them for help. And they would provide a complete program for all of our top staff people, and without any charge to us. And we benefited greatly from their courses. And we carried out and prepared training courses for almost all of our employees then, and it was well received. And I'm sure good training is still going on in the division today. But the Cooks and Bakers School for the Navy Department was one of the best, I think, in the country, according to the Navy. And Mrs. Helen Giesel was, and chefs, Carson Gully and Lydia Jones, and really did a marvelous job with training the Navy cooks and bakers. And whenever they had their big graduation, my God, they'd invite the governor down and all of the brass from along the line. I don't know, I this has been hit and miss as I go along here, but I certainly enjoyed the years I was at the university, I think the married student housing was transferred over. They built, you know, faculty housing out Eagle Heights, and that first was run by Buildings and Grounds, and then they turned it over to us. And so,
what was it first run by Buildings and Grounds?
I don't know. They planned the whole thing, and then later on, when we got into the married student housing, first was the faculty housing, then we got in on it. And then Fritz Lutze was our manager out there for many years, and he was former house fellow and staff on our staff here. But Bill Smith, I'm sure he gave me a lot of more data on it.
Well, we really
have, yeah.
Sure. Did you find other universities? As you mentioned, you were associated with more of a national organization of university housing. Did you find outside universities coming to check our system here and taking ideas from our system and using them in their own?
Yes, we had some of that, certainly. But I think that other universities are, well, we stole from each other, I'm sure, back and forth. And we had, and the Big Ten group had really good relations.
Did UW have a reputation as being, in the Big Ten at least, as being perhaps the top dog in housing or one of the...
Well, I suppose I shouldn't say so, but I think so.
Yeah.
Yes.
I would think with the innovations of the hospital.
Yes, yes.
Can I ask you some questions? Do you have any more, Steve?
I'd like to ask one question dealing with people along with the section you want to deal with now. But, do you remember a Bob Moser?
Sure.
A dean, I believe he was in education.
Yes.
And I understand he wrote a thesis dealing with Under Helverson that might have been used for the house fellow instruction.
Yeah, we use part of it. Yeah, I've got it at home someplace.
Oh, you do?
I think so.
Is it written here in Madison? We're trying to track it down.
It was done with a as a thesis.
As a master's or PhD?
Yes, master's.
Here in Madison?
Yes.
Oh, well, then it'll be in the...
You can't
find it. Did you check
it
again?
Uh-huh. I went through a...
Cool. Card catalog. It may be taken out or it may be lost or something.
Bob is... Where is he now?
He was in a car accident, I heard. And is now living in Fond du Lac.
Yeah.
I saw his name mentioned in this newsletter, that's why I...
Well, here, I got it. Here's our house fellow directory. What year it was, I'd have to go through.
Okay, a couple of questions that are related more to the university as a whole, as opposed to housing specifically. Were you a member of a dining club at all?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. What dining club was that?
Well, it was A.W. Peterson, Don Halverson, Asher Hobson, the vice president, John Weaver,
mm-hmm.
and his father Andy Weaver, and Baldwin,
mm-hmm.
and there were 10 of us.
Did you, were you in it for a fairly long period of time?
Well, not as long as Don, I'm sure, but I was in it for a long time.
What happened to them?
Well, I think that most of them retired and they did take in young people.
What did you do at a dining club meeting? What was the purpose of it?
Everything. It was just a good dining, drinking, I think. Storytelling, but then they'd discuss everything.
Research.
The president of the Houston University, research, and Baldwin was a great research.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And let's see. Oh, and we went on fishing trips up in Trout Lake.
It's kind of like a social intellectual.
It was no real purpose. It was just get together good. And also it was the president of the Madison Gas and Electric Company, what was his name. It wasn't all university people. And the assistant to the governor, what was his name? But it was a, when I get home, I'll look it up and get the names and send them. But,
now, as a person associated with housing, you and Mr. Halverson, was there any, did you ever feel like you were, like your status wasn't equal to the president? Was there any differentiation in those areas?
No, actually, we were both on the faculty, you know.
I didn't know that you were considered faculty.
Yes, I was associate professor. Don was full professor. I think the with the business office, why we were extremely close, and yeah, and with the presidents like President Fred, I never felt it. Maybe it was him.
No, I don't think. I'm just wondering if you felt it. That was why I asked. I have no indication that it ever was. Let's go through the president for a second.
Sure.
What about Glenn Frank?
Well, he was a great talker. He was a great bullshitter. He was not my favorite. He was certainly not a good administrator, but he was a wonderful talker. He would just talk to me all the time. But he was well thought of as a president, and I guess you'd have to rate him high.
Do you say he's not a good administrator? Is that just kind of a general impression?
Just a general impression.
Okay. What about Clarence Dexter?
I think he was an excellent administrator, and he wasn't, from the standpoint of the faculty, ever accepted as well, I don't think.
Any reason, any guess on why?
I think because he was more of a business person than an administrator than as a faculty member. His wife was a peach. He was very good, and we always did the catering for them.
Did you do any catering for Glenn Frank's staff?
Oh, yeah.
How were you generally treated, received
like
by him?
He'd always be nice. She was, I think, looked down on everybody. But Glenn Frank was always friendly, and he was good as far as the calls were concerned, but I think Dykstra was much more of the businessman. Mm-hmm. And then E.B. Fred went back to the educational emphasis. But Fred was one of our best friends. And Mrs. Fred was just a wonderful person.
Yeah, you just said something that I find very intriguing. You said E.B. Fred went back to the educational part. Again, by implication, are you saying perhaps that Glenn Frank and Dykstra did not focus on that as much, or that E.B. Fred brought?
I think maybe Glenn Frank did, but I don't think Dykstra did.
Okay.
He was a much more of an administrator,
mm-hmm.
and I think Glenn Frank was. Oh, he just loved to talk, and his wife was a problem, I think. As far as I'm concerned, that, I hope that thing isn't running.
It is, but that's what we wanted anyway.
But we did a catering for the Dykstras, and for the Franks, and for the Fred.
Do you have a favorite E.B. Fred story?
Well, I'd have to think of it, but I'm sure I do have, because they lived right straight across from Slichter Hall, you know, there. And man, oh man, they ate every Sunday noon meal over at Van Nuys Hall or Carson Gully now.
With the students?
Oh, yes, yeah. And E.B. Fred would talk with anybody, I don't care who it was. night watchman or anybody and students. He was not an administrator, but he was a very good politician. I mean, everybody liked him. And he wasn't a great talker either, I don't think. But I think Dykstra perhaps worked with the central governor's office and so on better than any of them, perhaps, in my estimation. And he, if we wanted something and we needed it, boy, he would get it. Glenn Frank was always putting it on the back burner, was his favorite expression. But he was well-liked, he was an educator. He was maybe too nice to be president, to tell you the truth. He wasn't the administrator that the other guys were, but maybe better. I don't know. Certainly was well thought of, and as far as a gentleman, he was.
Were you here when he was dismissed? Glenn Frank, I'm talking about now.
Yeah, sure.
Do you remember that?
No, I have to think.
Board of Regents took a vote in late 1936, and the students rallied to his support. And
yeah, there was a lot of fussing around at the time, but I can't remember too much. I used to wait on table at the union, catering, and I'd always, oftentimes would get hooked on, you know, taking care of the programs where they had business. They didn't want to get out. But I will say this, that beer at the union, the regents were meeting, and I was waiting on them. And I asked after what they would like to drink. And Matt Warner was one of the regents. He said, well, what do you have, Lee? I said, we have most everything. Well, he says, how about a beer? Yes, sir. And I went around the table, and I think there were seven of them, six that wanted beer. And Miss Waters, Elizabeth Waters, didn't, of course, and the president didn't. And Warner says, well, gentlemen, he says, I assume we can count this as a vote on the beer and the union. I ran downstairs and got, Don was in the grill, Georgian grill, eating lunch. And I told him, for God's sake, get some beer. And Chuck Dollard was with him. He ran down State Street, bought the beer, and I served it. And so that was the vote. And the doggone, the reporters were always after news from the regents. We had to be careful. Anything at all, they were there. I didn't tell them, but they finally found out when we beer at the union.
That's the first time, right? That started.
I hadn't thought of it until. But Matt Warner, didn't recall any big scandal about him. But maybe I'm forgetting things.
I think I've asked every fellow these days.
Is there anybody that comes to mind who, when you were director, who was particularly helpful, like either in the faculty or especially the regents, any regents that were, you know, that you found were backing housing so that I might, you know, go to them, their papers or something? Anybody who was always, you know, asked you what you needed, or anybody in the regents that was particularly on your side?
No. I'd have to go back. Dykstra was a great help always in anything we needed. He was a good administrator. Dr. Fred was very helpful, but it took him forever to make up his mind as to what we were going to do and whatnot. Glenn Frank was not one of my favorites as far as administrators are concerned. I think Leroy Luberg was a good help. He was secretary to him. He's dead now, though, isn't he?
Well, yeah, we got a great interview with him, a long one.
Yeah, that's
good. You ought to take a look at that. Might have some stuff, some material.
He was a very nice fellow, and his wife was, too. I don't know. The Regents were always fair with us. I never had an awful lot of stuff. It mostly went through A.W. Peterson and to the Regents. Yeah. He was a great guy. He was tremendous.
Do you, Mr. Burns, do you have any closing statements you'd like to make?
Well, I sure love the University of Wisconsin, and it's been good to me. We worked hard, but we played hard. And I have a great deal of fondness for the housing organization. And I think I would put it up against any of the Big Ten groups. I remember Alice calling from Indiana wanting to know about how the hell do you get along with this Navy group, he says. I said, there's nothing to it. Do what you say and what you want to do. But they had a lot of time. But I know we had a Big Ten group and we got together right here and there and then formed that association, college and university and, housing officers, and that helped. But I don't know. I hope the dorms will continue on the way they have been going, and I know under Newell we had some wonderful help. Now the new director I haven't met. Hope to stop in and see him sometime in the autumn, but I hope they continue on with the. And I may say this, that we had wonderful help from the faculty. I mean, kids having trouble or anything like that, would sometimes they'd call up, and then we could work through the house fellow and the house organizations and straighten them out.
So a faculty member might perceive a problem and call you.
Oh, yeah.
And then
you would
work it out through the house fellow.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And their student government has been very, the MHA was been housing association was they run the store, and it was good training for them, and we could always turn to them, and we did, and we worked closely with the students, and then the house fellow group there. Can just see. I don't know if you can.